From the Sky News Centre at 6. Another member of the government's Drug Advisory Council has quit. Eric Carlin says the decision to ban methadone this week was unduly based on media and political pressure. He's the seventh member of the council to resign since the sacking of former chairman Professor David Nutt, who says it's become too easy to label drug users as criminals.
Heroin's been illegal for 100 years, and yet still we have one person a day dies of it. So we shouldn't rush to criminalise things if there might be alternative, better approaches to reduce harm.
Britain's urged both Israelis and Palestinians to show restraint following an escalation of violence. Israeli air raids were in retaliation for rocket attacks from Gaza, and Israel's warned of renewed efforts to protect its citizens. Yaakov Katz is a journalist at the Jerusalem Post. He believes there could be a repeat of the offensive that left more than 1,000 Palestinians dead early last year.
It could lead to a larger operation. I think that Israel would prefer containment to try to keep things along the border calm and quiet. But it is prepared for the possibility that it may have to launch another large-scale operation like it did about 15 months ago inside Gaza.
Teachers are raising the threat of industrial action in what could become a summer of discontent for a new government. A priority motion is to be debated at the National Union of Teachers annual conference in Liverpool this weekend. It calls for a joint campaign with the TUC and public sector unions, including strikes if necessary, to oppose any cuts to services, threats to pensions and pay freezes. There's Easter holiday travel disruption in Dover. Sea France has had to cancel all its services because of wildcat strikes by French staff. Operation Stag has been introduced by Kent Police, meaning part of the M20 motorway is being used to park lorries. In sport, David Hay will be the smaller man for his first defence of his WBA World Heavyweight title. The Londoner has weighed in at 15 stone 12. He takes on John Ruiz on Saturday. That's the latest. I'm Sasha Twyman.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
BCFM is a community radio station for Bristol. So, what exactly does that mean? Well, it means that anybody can get involved in any way you want. Yeah, but what if you haven't done radio before? That doesn't matter, because BCFM have qualified tutors that run training courses that tell you everything you need to know. To find out more information, go to www.bcfm.org.uk.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with me, Tony Gosling, Martin Summers and Kevin McGimpsey. Easter, what's it all about? And Easter bunnies, what have they got to do with the Jewish Passover and the crucifixion of Jesus nearly 2,000 years ago today? We look at how the date is determined and at some of the different religious traditions that brought us here. And one of the best dramas ever produced in Bristol, Private Eye Eddie Shoestring, played by Trevor Eve in 1979 and 1980, and produced by the BBC locally. Why has it still not had an official release on DVD? And where can you get it from? If you have a pen and paper ready, if you're a fan of the Shoestring series, I'll be talking about that towards 7 o'clock. But before all that, we continue with our look at the Northern Ireland Good Friday Agreement.
Yes, and I'm Martin Summers, and we have here Kevin McGimpsey, who's from Northern Ireland. He's actually an artist based in Bristol. And Kevin, I believe you've got a poem that you've written,
yes,
which you'd like to read to us, related to the topic that we're discussing.
Yes, it was written to commemorate the death of a musician who worked at Harland Wolff Shipyard. He could play piano and he could pick up anything on first hearing, from an Irish air to a Scottish dance to to jazz or to classical. And this is about him, but it's also about the shipyards and about the docks where the Catholic workers normally worked. And this is what it's sort of like to symbolise the passing of not a new person but a whole era. And it's called Leeward to the Shore. Incidentally, Samson, which is mentioned, and Goliath are the names of the two big cranes which dominate Belfast. Leeward to the Shore. He plays the keys, leeward to the shore. on silent wharves, incumbent cranes, where rust-driven rivets dance a tango and iron-framed glass tinkles in the rain. Shipbuilders from Sydenham, Bally McCarrot, stevedores of New Lodge and Tiger's Bay, let time rush on through its flame and fury to pack your pieces for posterity. Scott Joplin plays ragtime on Samson's jawbone. Billie Holiday takes Goliath's sword for a swing. While seagulls soar, the dashing white sergeant crying, farewell to Erin over Carrickfergus Bay. Shipbuilders of Sydenham, Bally McCarrot, stevedores of New Lodge and Tiger's Bay, lower that allegro, quavered murmur. Your song has heaved its load to rest. He plays a waltz time, leeward to the shore, slip jigging down slipways cracked and green, where a sonata of steel clamps on a well-oiled reel, and iron-framed glass tinkles in the rain.
Well, thank you very much for that, Kevin. And, of course, the poem is about music, about singing, and I believe you have a song that you would like to sing for us. It's not your song, it's quite a famous song, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is quite a famous song, and what is interesting about it is that it's a reconciliation song, in a sense. It was also written by an Englishman about Ireland, and it's become a big tune, which is being played by everybody from the Dubliners to Mary Black to Dick Gochan as well. So this is
your unaccompanied version now.
This is my version of it. Walking all the day by tall towers where falcons build their nests. Silver wing they fly, they know the call of freedom in their breasts. I saw black head against the sky, with twisted rocks run down to the sea, living on your western shore. Saw the summer sunsets, how we cried out for more. Stood by your Atlantic sea and sang a song for Ireland. Drinking all the day in the small pubs where the fiddlers love to play. I saw one, she touched a bow and she played a reel which seemed so grand and gay. I stood on Dingle Beach and cast in the wild foam. We found Atlantic bass. Living on your western shore, saw the summer sunsets, how we cried out for more. Stood by your Atlantic sea and sang a song for Ireland. Talking all the day with true friends who try to make you stay. Telling jokes and news while singing songs to pass the time away. I watched the Galway salmon run like silver darting, dancing in the sun. Living on your western shore, saw summer sunsets while we cried out for more. Stood by your Atlantic sea and sang a song for Ireland. Dreaming in the night, I saw a land where no one had to fight. But wakened in your dawn, I saw you crying in the morning light. Lying where the falcons fly, oh, they twist and turn through your air blue sky. Living on your western shore, saw the summer sunsets while I cried out for more. Stood by your Atlantic sea and sang a song for Ireland.
Thank you very much for that, Kevin. I believe we're going to move on to back to the politics now.
Well, I think before we do that, it'd be nice to just ask Kevin about where people can find him on the internet.
Oh, yes,
and also possibly if you've got any gigs coming up, Kevin.
Well, I don't have any gigs coming up immediately, but I can be accessed online. You just go to www.virb.com, that's verb, virb.com, / Ohiski, which is the Irish word for water horse, which is my my group name, and that's AUGHISKY. So access me online at that address.
And what are the sort of venues around the city that you've been performing?
Well, everything from the Thunderbolt to the Fleece and Firkin to the Prom on Gloucester Road.
I saw you at the Junction, didn't I?
At the Junction, yep, I've done that. I've done as many places as will have me.
Well, I'd just like to thank you very much for coming in and doing these recitations. And I'm sure if anyone wants to follow you, they can find you on that website that you just gave there. Maybe we'll give the... probably a good idea to give the website again at the end of the programme. Right, Martin, we're now carrying on with our chronological look at the Irish Troubles and the and Good Friday Agreement, particularly because it's Good Friday today. First of all, we're on now really up to the late 1970s and looking at the Republicans and the Nationalists and the hunger strike, because I know you were actually quite active when you were at Oxford University in supporting the hunger strikers.
Yeah, we formed a committee called, we called it Charter 80, which was modelled on the Charter 77, was a Czech dissident movement. And so we formed a committee in Oxford University called Charter 80 to support the demands of the hunger strikers, not to support the armed struggle, not to support the IRA, but to support the demands of the hunger strikers, because we felt that it was important to kind of politicise the issue. Let's do politics. Let's do politics. And of course, during the hunger strikes, people forget, the IRA called ceasefires during those hunger strikes, so that the focus would be on what was happening in the prisons. And it was a very, very tragic experience and a very tragic time. I remember the first hunger strike was called off at the Christmas, and we thought that the demands had been granted, and there was a kind of palpable sense of relief that some kind of sense had prevailed. And then of course it turned out in the new year that no concessions had been made, the hunger strike had been called off under false pretenses, and then the second hunger strike began, which ended up with 10 hunger strikers dead. And there's the film Hunger, as I went to see that not long ago. That's very harrowing account of how that was. But of course, tragic as it was, it turned the political situation around, because the Republican movement realised that politics was ultimately the way forward, and that became very important in the end. Of course, we're moving on now to talk about the loyalist side. I mean, we've heard a lot about the Republican side, the Nationalist side on the programme thus far, and of course the Good Friday Agreement could never have been made without the loyalist side, and that includes the mainstream politicians and the paramilitaries. As I mentioned earlier, I think on air, I met Gary McMichael and David Irving, leaders of the Ulster Defence Association and the Ulster Volunteer Force, respectively, at a conference in the TUC in London. And the peace agreement could not have been made without the goodwill of the loyalist community. I mean, we've been very critical of everything that the state stood for, and lots of criticism has been made. But in the end, the peace agreement was made by both communities. And I think that's one of the things I'd really like to stress. That the peace agreement was a fantastic political achievement by all concerned, by both governments, by all the political leaders. They all showed tremendous courage in bringing their people to this agreement.
Because I can remember there were several false starts, weren't there? There were people that thought there had been an agreement, but no ceasefire then transpired. What about the Pope's visit in 1979?
Well, the Pope was important as well. He came in 1979 before the hunger strike, and he basically put a lot of political... This is Pope John Paul, put a lot of political pressure on the Republican movement to call off the armed struggle. And it put the Republican movement on the back foot, and on that back foot they decided, right, well, if you can show us another way to do it, we'll try and find a way. And that's when Hume and Adams got together and started to talk about what the way out of the conflict might be. So the Pope actually played quite a big role in encouraging those talks. And of course Hume came in for a lot of criticism for talking to Adams and the IRA, but he said, look, you've got to talk to these people and let's get some rational discussion going here. And Hume represented the SDLP, the more moderate faction of the nationalist movement, and but they got their act together, and having got their act together, they were then able to go to the British government and say, look, these are the kind of conditions that we need to call off the violence, and let's try and find some kind of solution.
It's a strange one, because you alluded to the Pope's visit. There was Garth Fitzgerald with a fairly tenuous coalition government, I beg your pardon, the word escaped me there for a second, did sign the Anglo-Irish agreement with Margaret Thatcher at the time. And I think what we have failed to allude to so far in the discussion is the fact that before Thatcher came to power in 1979 in the UK, there had been considerable civil unrest, not just in Northern Ireland. Unemployment was rife. There was a lot of idle hands out of work, idle young hands out of work. And I think, once the Falklands War started, the Republican military framework realised that actually this woman was playing hardball, and she wasn't really going to take any prisoners, and didn't really care how many people got crushed in the process. And I think that
she was a great recruiting sergeant from their point of view.
Oh, absolutely. And for an awful lot of other causes around the world, yeah. I think you'll find that it was the nature of the beast at the time. It was the time of big government. And ironically, if we look at today, I'm afraid to say what Tony Blair did for an awfully long time under his 11-year tenure, was very Thatcherite in his outlook. It was
the only positive.
Sorry, with the attitude to Ireland, of course, it was completely different.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that's the only... I was asked when he resigned on BBC South West what was my verdict on Tony Blair, and I said it's a shame he's going to be not going to be remembered for bringing peace and reconciliation to Ireland. He's going to be remembered for bringing war and misery to Iraq.
I don't know,
because he did play his part.
He played a very small part and took a huge amount of credit.
Oh, he did. I would agree with that, but nevertheless, this political agreement only stuck because everybody was involved, including him.
I think you're right.
And John Major also played his role.
We'll get into the meat of it now, really.
And the same goes for Bertie Ahern, and also for the all the political... I mean, I would just like to say the change of attitude on the loyalist side was tremendous.
I absolutely agree with you.
But hang on, let's get back to Blair for a minute. This is quite a knotty issue, isn't it? Don't you think that really his contribution to peace in Ireland was kind of nixed by the fact that he then got involved in starting illegal foreign wars?
Well, some would say that he actually took the credit that was due to Mo Mollem.
I would agree with that, and also it's important to remember Mo Mollem ended up with the poison chalice of Northern Ireland's secretary in the first place, because she had the temerity to speak out against him about some other minor incident earlier on.
She was banished to Siberia in Belfast, yes.
Yeah, absolutely, because actually she was quite a forthright individual. She was articulate, and much to Tony Blair's chagrin, she could take him on his level and beat him consistently.
Yeah. Right, well, we're going to be talking about the signing of the Good Friday Agreement 12 years ago today in a moment, but first, Sharon Shannon.
I thought you got some...
Thank you.
Yes, The Blackbird there by Sharon Shannon. Welcome back to BCFM's Friday Drive Time with me, Tony Gosling. Joining me in the studio is Martin Summers, our Oxford political pundit and also many times visitor to Northern Ireland, and also Billy Quain from the BCFM Arts Show on Saturday morning, which is at what time, Billy?
10 a.m. tomorrow, live and loud.
Okay, now we've come all the way through all the history of Northern Ireland, really up till 1997. And 1997 was when Tony Blair and the new Labour government were elected, and he appointed Mo Molum as his Northern Ireland secretary. Why do you think he did that, Martin?
Well, there are various theories that she was being kicked, you know, she was being punished by being sent to Northern Ireland or whatever, but she made it her own. And she was actually, as we now know, very ill. She was actually dying of the brain tumour that eventually killed her. But she threw everything into trying to get an agreement. And because she was an outsider with a kind of, you know, as she said at one stage in the negotiations, I've got to get this done, because she knew she was dying. You know, this is something I want to go down having achieved. And I think all sides would recognise that her role of bringing people together and getting knocking heads together was extremely useful.
OK, let's go over now to RTE, the Irish broadcasters, and hear the news announcement of the appointment of Mo Molum and the election of the Blair government.
The British Prime Minister completes his cabinet appointments with the first woman Northern Secretary. On a walkabout in Belfast, Dr. Mo Molum says the ball is in the IRA's court.
Mo Molum's celebrated informality was much in evidence as she arrived in Belfast with a mock grimace for the boisterous media scrum that awaited her. After restoring order, she insisted on first taking questions from women journalists, who asked her what she was bringing to the job.
Sensitivity in some senses, but at the same time a directness and an openness which may help the process too. But all I can do is bring people together.
But Sinn Féin couldn't be brought into the political process until there was a ceasefire.
A ceasefire is necessary, and the ball is in the IRA's court. That is the bottom line.
And peace was the bottom line for many of the shoppers she met on an extraordinarily warm political walkabout.
Do my best.
Through all the security, her breezy style struck a chord, particularly with the women she met. There were many queries about her health and the recent disclosure that she'd been treated for a brain tumour.
There is a genuine decency among people, I believe, and if you were honest as I was, I think it makes a hell of a difference.
Mo Molum may have arrived at a time of unique opportunity. Her government has a huge working majority, Sinn Féin has increased its mandate, and the pressure is now clearly on for a fresh IRA ceasefire.
I think that the majority which her government has permits Mr. Blair and Mo Molum to not just lead their own people into the new millennium, but to actually establish a firm foundation for peace and a lasting peace between the people of these two islands. So I wish her well.
So we just heard from Gerry Adams there at the very end of that clip. The ceasefires obviously were very important. I mean, one of the things I used to say to my Republican friends was, just call it off. Don't have to give any guns over. Let's just call it off, and then let's see what politics can do. And they did, in fact, take that road. There were several ceasefires. Of course, the first ceasefire is in 1975, but the time wasn't right. There was another ceasefire between 94 and 96, which broke down. And then the final ceasefire, which settled the business in 1998, which, of course, led up to the agreement on Good Friday.
It's interesting to reflect on the number of tried and failed attempts, and actually it was the consensus. Interesting also to point out Bill Clinton and at the time, oh God, her name escapes me, Madeleine Albright, were applying appreciable pressure on both governments, on Blair's government and on the Dublin government, to actually really start wringing some necks and get people around the table, because that was the really most difficult part, to get Paisley and Adams to sit down across the same
table. Of course, it was originally Trimble and Adams, because Paisley was out of the thing. He didn't want to know. He was intransigent. And, of course, that was really problematic. And, of course, eventually, of course, the DUP, his party, became the dominant party on the loyalist side, and that looked as if it was going to scupper everything. So when Mr. Paisley, the Reverend Ian Paisley himself, sat down with his IRA enemies and said, let's do a deal, that's when it really began
to stick. That's when it validated everything, because the two extremities...
And full marks to Mr. Paisley there. Full marks. He'd been a very intransigent politician, very problematic, but his people trusted him because he'd always stuck up for them and their point of view. And he had the same kind of attitude as his opponents. But of course, he was able to move in the end, and that was fantastic.
At this point, 1997, the IRA, of course, still had their guns. It's very, yeah.
Well, there was a lot of fuss about that, of course, but it was resolved. The peace process itself and the way it came about is now being exported. It's one of Britain's greatest exports. Yeah, we send DUP leaders and ex-IRA leaders to go and talk to people in Palestine and in all these other places around the world, because what the Irish peace process shows, that if you talk to your enemies, there's always a possibility that you might find an agreement, and talking is the way there.
So, on this day, 12 years ago, the Good
Friday...
It wasn't
exactly this day, was it? It's Good Friday.
On Good Friday, yes. This day is Good Friday.
12 we're going years to be ago. Talking about Easter in a minute, but it was the 12th, it was the 12th of April.
It was 12, yes, the 12th of April, but on Good Friday, 12 years ago, the agreement was signed. And here is Peter Sissons, who was the main BBC newsreader at the time, announcing it.
Good evening. 17 and a half hours after the midnight deadline, with a simple announcement this evening by the talks chairman, Northern Ireland was given the chance of a new beginning. After nearly 2 years of talks, after 30 years of conflict, after thousands of violent deaths and centuries of bitterness. In the end, the political parties, nationalist and unionist, republican and loyalist, and the two governments decided there was no other way. The core of the agreement is a new Northern Ireland Assembly with 108 members elected by proportional representation. If the agreement is approved by referendums in the North and South, the Assembly will select an executive of 12 ministers with positions shared among the parties according to their electoral strength. Their power to make law will exclude security matters, which will remain with the Northern Ireland Secretary. To sort out relations with the Irish Republic, the deal calls for a ministerial council linking the Belfast and Dublin governments. It will have executive powers endorsed by the Assembly. And to underpin the new relationship, the Republic will abandon its constitutional claims on the territory of Northern Ireland. Other changes would replace existing British-Irish agreements...
Yeah, that's Peter Sissons there on Good Friday in 1998. Announcing the signing of the Good Friday Agreement. Firstly, Martin and Billy, I mean, it sounds like they had a deadline, but they didn't actually make the deadline, and it was something like 18 hours after the deadline that they actually announced they had an agreement. That was a very, very difficult time, because many people thought that was it, because they hadn't signed by the deadline.
Well, I think they signed on Good Friday. I mean, the British civil servants involved in the negotiations set the deadline on Good Friday, because they knew that it would put maximum pressure on all sides to come up with a deal. And it was a great Easter present for Ireland and for Britain. And of course, they didn't solve all the problems. My goodness, there was an awful lot of wrangling to go after the agreement was signed. I mean, eventually, of course, there had to be a referendum in the South to change the constitution, to change the territorial demand that was being made on the six counties,
which is Article 2 or something.
Yes, and also the people in the North had to. The whole of Ireland voted on the same day, since the first time since 1918, because of course the IRA had always drawn their legitimacy from the fact that they'd won the election in 1918, and they saw that as their mandate to do whatever they were going to do. And of course this vote superseded that 1918 vote, because it was all 32 counties voting on the same day on the same deal. And that was an achievement.
It was a massive achievement. And actually, I was living in Bristol at the time, so the sense of relief that I felt when it came through was palpable. I hate to admit it, for the first couple of years I was in Bristol, it was in and around the time of the Canary Wharf bombing. There was an awful lot of ill feeling to the Irish population, towards the Irish population, which I must reiterate again, is a deeply entrenched population in the city of Bristol. I mean, there are 40,000 of us first born and expat here. And it was a dark time. And it, interestingly, was about the time that Irish pubs were proliferating all over the place. So it was very strange. You drink our stout, but you wouldn't give us the time of day. It has been a success But a quantified success, I would say. There most recently was the attack on the army barracks with the pizza delivery guy, two soldiers killed again.
Ah, well.
And, you know, there's these little disparate splinter groups from unhappy or disenfranchised individuals, former IRA individuals, because let's not ever forget the fact wartime is profit time. If you look at any of the profiteers of war down through the centuries, it played into some individual's hands.
To be honest with you, Billy, I went to Belfast in 2000 and I was actually talking to continuity IRA activists, and I was saying to them, look, you know, what are you going to gain by carrying on? And what I found with them is that they weren't actually motivated by greed. They were motivated by misplaced idealism. Misplaced, because they're basically, the deal on the table was the best deal that anybody was ever going to get.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republican movement, in my view, has been very lucky in the quality of its leaders. We mentioned Sheena Campbell, who got murdered earlier. She's, you know, she was definitely presidential material. But, I mean, people like Mr. Adams and Mr. McGuinness were high quality. I mean, they left school at 16. But they're very, very high quality people, and they're able to lead their people forward to peace. And I reiterate, as I was stressing earlier, the loyalist paramilitary leadership and the loyalist mainstream leadership also did the right thing by their people. They stood by what they got out of the agreement was that they were not going to be bullied into United Ireland against their will, and that was made absolutely clear that was not going to happen. And as John Hume said about the agreement, the reason it works is because it's a hologram and everybody can see in it what they want to see in it. The Unionists can see that their position in the United Kingdom has been secured. The Republicans can see that one day there may be a United Ireland by consent. Everybody has got something to play for. And of course, politics is a rough old game, but let's not play it with guns, let's play it with ballots and discussion. That's the way to do it.
I agree, there's a lot of positives to be drawn from it. They're not bombing each other to smithereens anymore. However, it is still imperfect.
It's not fixed. I mean, we had a chap over here from Andersonstown, and he was talking, he was speaking in Kabylie, actually, and this classic sort of middle-class English woman at the back said, well, why can't you just get on with each other, and you know, what's this all about? And he said, madam, at the end of my road, there is a wall twice the height of these houses over here. And they live on the other side of that wall, and we live on this side of that wall. Mm-hmm. And they hate us, and we hate them. And they're never going to love us, and we ain't never going to love them. But what the agreement gives us is we don't have to kill each other. And it doesn't mean that we have to love each other. We probably don't love each other. In fact, we don't love each other. But the fact is, we've all agreed that killing each other is a damn fool's game. And that's the point.
It's a step forward, certainly. Tony, we're moving on.
Yes, I mean, we're moving on, rolling along to 2005 now, which is, I think, probably before we hear the tribute to Dr. Mo Molum, I'd like to hear from both of you, you know, what you think her contribution was.
Well, it was very important. That was the height of her political career.
It was what really made... Do you think she was the person that made the agreement work, ultimately?
I think the fact that she was the kind of person she was helped. I mean, we've been very lucky with a certain personal chemistry involved in this. I mean, another personal chemistry which was very helpful is that Martin McGuinness and Reverend Ian Paisley actually got on famously, which was just a... Which was just a cherry on the cake.
An interesting aside there.
Well, yes, but it is. It's fascinating that they actually got on so well. They're personal friends, you know. They pop round and visit each other now. Well, isn't that great?
I think they're equally passionate and deeply entrenched in their own standpoint.
Exactly, but they understand each other because they've got similar attitude to life.
They suffer from the same feverish passion. On the Mo Molum point, I would say she's an extraordinary loss. But by the same token, her loss is tempered by the successful legacy that she left behind. A famous, extraordinary woman.
For more than 40 years, Ian Paisley...
Ian Paisley's getting in there where Mo should be, unfortunately. I'll tell you what, why don't we just have a little chat about Ian Paisley and his contribution, because this is quite an interesting little clip I've got here with an interview between Paisley and David Frost. So you were actually talking about Paisley there, weren't you?
Yeah, well, what was fascinating is when the DUP and Ian Paisley finally signed up to the agreement, it was supposed to be signed, I think, in March, and basically... The Republican side were aware that Paisley was prepared to sign up, and as far as they were concerned, they didn't care whether it was March, September, you know, whenever. But Paisley, in order to keep his own people happy, had to show that he was being tough, and he was saying, I'm not signing it in March. And, of course, the Republicans didn't care whether he signed it in March or whatever, but they put on their best sort of stony faces and looked as if they were fed up, because that's what he needed them to do, and that's what they did. They looked fed up, even though they weren't fed up at all, because they knew he was going to sign, and they were happy for him to sign, and they were actually ready to go, yippee, we got the deal. But of course, in order for him to carry his own people, the Republicans had to look sour.
And
they played that game as the professionals they were. They played it absolutely straight. They looked sour. And then, of course, Mr. Paisley signed up, and that was great.
There are two small aspects to Paisley which I have minor issue with. I admire his passion. I always have, his zeal, his oratory. However, first off, he was always given full representation in the national media in the UK and in Ireland, something which we have neglected to mention so far. All of the Republican speakers had a broadcasting ban on them for an awfully long time, so we're never being fully represented in the media to allow the public
What was the section of the Irish law that banned them from the media in the Republic?
Cool, you're getting quite detailed.
No, but I mean, they were banned for quite a long time.
I can remember certainly growing up and actor's voice sprayed across the bottom, and actually they didn't even broadcast a headshot of Gerry Adams for a long time. It was the back of his head we got. So I'm quite familiar with you know, his collars, but not so good with his face.
They brought in the media blocking Republicans from the media in the Republic after the Dublin and Monaghan bombs of 1972. Mm-hmm. And the then Dublin government rushed in through this emergency legislation. The irony being, of course, that the Dublin and Monaghan bombs were planted by loyalists terrorists in cahoots with the British intelligence services, according to the Garda Síochána. So the British blow up Dublin and Monaghan, and then the Dublin government brings in repressive legislation on the back of it. And that was a craven moment for Dublin. It was really craven.
Anyway, what I'd really like to do now is have a little listen to Ian Paisley, since he seemed to be sort of forcing his way in there in front of Mo Molem. Let's now have a listen to that interview with Ian Paisley by David Frost.
For more than 40 years, Ian Paisley has been an unmistakable and controversial figure in Northern Ireland politics. A staunch unionist, he was nicknamed Dr. No because he refused to meet or even share the same room as nationalists or Republicans. And he'd certainly never talk about power sharing with them. But as the peace process moved forward, so did Ian Paisley, until the astonishing day last year when he became First Minister of Northern Ireland, with the staunch Republican Martin McGuinness becoming his deputy. Ian Paisley, power sharing with Sinn Féin. A month ago he announced that he's to retire as First Minister in May. And political leaders who once denounced him regularly suddenly queued up to pay him compliments. I began by trying to explore how and why this change came about. In Jonathan Powell, in his new book about the proceedings, says that when you were very, very ill in 2004,
yes,
that afterwards he thought when you came out of that ordeal, as it were, that you had changed in some way, you had reevaluated, and that's why you moved from the famous thing of being Dr. No to being, in certain cases, Dr. Yes. Do you think that was a watershed in your life, that illness and that time to...
No, well, I mean, I have always enjoyed absolute good health. And, of course, it was a shock to me not to be well. And, of course, that does shake you. I mean, when you come to face weakness and come to face what eventually could be death, I mean, it does shake you. But, no, it wasn't... What really changed me was I said to the Prime Minister, he had made a statement saying that, of course, if anybody wanted to be in the government of Northern Ireland, would have to abide by democratic principles. I'd have to obey the courts, I'd have to support the police, and they would have to sign up that they did support the police. And I took that up, and I said, look, if they do that, I'm prepared to do something. I'm prepared to go into coalition with them, which of course was a bombshell. But the bombshell was conditional on that, and eventually, after a very long haggle, we got that. They did sign up, and I mean, for instance, Gerry Adams, their leader, has recently had a meeting with the chief of police on his request in his own district to talk about security for his people. Well, if you had told me that would have happened two or three years ago, I would have laughed in your face and said, you better go to the asylum, you're mad. But it did happen. And I must say that the obligations that they took, they have kept. There's other obligations that they haven't as yet seen their way to bring into existence. Like, they're still in this army of council of the IRA, and I think that no person who wants to go on in government of a country can remain in an army council of a terrorist organization. And I believe we've got to get that settled. And I'm confident that what we have settled, we can get a settlement on that. But that is the big obstacle at the moment that we have to work at and keep working at it.
At the same time, some people say, oh, well, if Dr. Paisley or Reverend Paisley or Ian Paisley had come to these decisions 20 years earlier, we could have had 20 years more of peace. But I presume you wouldn't agree with that, because you'd say the conditions weren't right then.
The Sinn Féin leadership said they were going to drive us out of the country, and by hook or by crook, we're going to have a united Ireland. And we were saying, by hook or by crook, we're not having a united Ireland. And then the things that needed to be done were left aside. But when they came to consider what were the conditions for peace with the Unionist people, and the conditions were law and order, a faithfulness to the government, and a signing up to the police. And when we got that, I could not, as a man of truth, I couldn't say, oh, no, I don't, that's not enough. I mean, those were the things that I saw we could get, basically. And we're not asking too much of a person to obey the law. If you want to be a lawmaker, you've got to be a lawkeeper. And that's that was the big issue.
That's Reverend Dr. Ian Paisley there, talking to David Frost in 2008.
You know how he got his doctorate, don't you?
No.
He sent $15 to Bob Jones University in Texas, which is very, very associated with the Bush family. And that's how he got his doctorate, Dr. Ian Paisley of Bob Jones University, cost him $15 in 1963.
But it's lovely to hear him there, Billy, isn't it? With the whole sort of reconciliation. because he was a real tub-thumping chap. In fact, I remember seeing riots kicking off immediately after one of his speeches in some of the loyalist areas.
Absolutely. Well, that's just it. He, as I politely alluded earlier, he was a great orator. Martin used another phrase earlier on that if people can be known to be incited to violence by the frenzy of speech. It's an odd one. I mean, I admire him as a performer. He's stunning. He really does hold an audience rapt. But I am deeply entrenched against his politics. I think he has had an unfair bias for an awfully long time in the mainstream media and in his own community. And also, he is a bit of a joker, I suppose, if you can look at the humorous side of what he does, standing up in the House of Parliament accusing the Pope of being the Antichrist, regardless of what your feelings for the Catholic Church are, I think...
Well, he was dragged out of the European Parliament, wasn't he? Kicking and screaming when the Pope came to visit.
It was the European Parliament, wasn't it, when he said the Antichrist?
No, he said dragged out, kicking and screaming. But, I mean, nevertheless, I mean, he represented a certain kind of hardline opinion on his side of the fence. Mm-hmm. And without him, the deal wouldn't have stuck.
There's no escaping the fact he has been consistent for 60 years.
I think what he was saying there was, I eventually came round to saying I will sit down with Sinn Féin and their IRA, but they've got to give up their guns and they've got to play the democratic game. And that was his bottom line. And that's fair enough, isn't it? That's okay. The way it's got
to
be.
Now let's have a listen to that US tribute to Mo Molum, which we were going to hear earlier on, and leave Ian Paisley and just have a look at her for a moment.
She was brave, she was passionate, she was a no-nonsense person. She said it as it was. Mo was unique.
She loosened up hearts and souls and minds, and we needed that at that time.
If you were honest as I was, I think it makes a hell of a difference. All I can do is bring people together.
The first time she came as Secretary of State, she walked the streets. And she was welcomed by both communities with open arms.
It was something people in Northern Ireland took to their hearts immediately.
Do my best.
Once again, the maze was the focal point of a troubled peace process today as Mo Mollum arrived for a visit that had been variously described as mad or brave. She was there to meet prisoners belonging to the outlawed Ulster Freedom Fighters and the Ulster Defence Association, who'd withdrawn their support for their representatives returning to Stormont on Monday.
It was a Saturday afternoon. I was watching it and I saw Mo going into the prison. And I remember saying to myself, my God, what made you do this? This is wrong. I mean, you shouldn't have done this. But then I was wrong, because the way in which she approached that actually helped to copper fasten what was going on outside.
We have a chance still to move this process forward. I don't believe that it's lost.
The agreement proposes changes in the Irish Constitution and in British constitutional law to enshrine the principle that it is the people of Northern Ireland who will decide, democratically, their own future.
I'm very happy for people in Northern Ireland, who I believe will now have the opportunity to build a peaceful future for themselves. They'll be able to do that first and foremost by the referendum vote at the end of May.
I hereby give notice that the percentage votes given at the referendum was as follows. Yes, 71.12%.
This is a majority of both communities. It is 3-in-1 saying let's move forward. Now, that to me is a pretty strong base to build on.
Every taxi you got into in Blackpool at the party conference, people would say, oh, that Mo Mollum, she is a star. What a fantastic woman. She's what politicians ought to be like. And that's what the general public felt, I think, everywhere. And I think that was really her outstanding legacy, was this woman who lit up the room when she walked into it.
Mo Mollum,
ladies and
gentlemen. Will you welcome, please, Mo Mollum.
And I thank our one and only Mo, of course.
Something I've never seen in 40 years of Labour Party conference, which is a stunning ovation for the Cabinet Minister during the Prime Minister's address.
I think I can say without fear of contradiction that that's the first time there's been a standing ovation in the middle of a speech. And the person getting the ovation isn't even the person making the speech.
That was a tribute to Mo Mollum there, put together by some of the US peace campaigners. Now, that little incident where Tony Blair's making a speech about Mo, and she is the one that gets the standing ovation rather than him, he did seem as if he was really trying to sort of almost stand as close to her as possible.
I think they call that basking in reflected glory, don't they?
Or do nothing. But is it fair to say that without Tony Blair as well, it wouldn't have happened?
No, absolutely not.
No.
I obviously, whoever the Prime Minister was, I mean, John Major did most of the negotiating. And, of course, having the Conservatives on side was very important, even for a Labour Prime Minister.
Yep.
And I'm a member of the Labour Party, of course, and, you know, Mo Mollum, I'd rather prefer to think of it as Mo's party rather than his party, but there you go. But everybody did their bit. The British Civil Service, the Irish Civil Service, the police forces on all sides. You know, everybody. This agreement is a fantastic achievement by everybody. And I think it's something that we can all be very proud of as British and Irish people.
But one of the most important sections of that agreement is this policing and justice business, which has just literally only now just been agreed.
Yeah.
And so why is policing and justice so important?
Well, it was obviously, we were talking earlier about how the trouble started and the role of the RUC as a sectarian force and all the rest of it. So getting a police force which everybody can get behind and support has been a key demand and a key principle that has got to be sorted out.
It's absolutely right. I was talking to a friend of mine, well, a friend of a friend, I would must be absolutely honest about it. He's a Catholic PSNI officer. And, you know, it struck me as odd in the first place. I said, listen, what's it like for you? And this is actual vernacular truth. He said, put yourself in my situation. If you were a Catholic 17-year-old caught drink driving or some incident, would you rather one of your own community turned up to deal with you as an individual, or would you rather a Protestant potentially entrenched in very polar views to your own turned up and took you through the judiciary thereafter? So I think it's going to take a while for Catholics to achieve any rank of significance within the police force, but they're going in the right direction.
Anyway, let's have a little listen now to Gordon Brown announcing this.
We believe we have proposals that make for a reasonable deal on the devolution of policing and justice. We believe we have proposals that make for a reasonable settlement. But we also know that there are issues outstanding from St Andrews, which, if unresolved, threaten the Assembly and threaten the Executive. We have looked at the issue of dates for devolution of policing and justice. We believe together that it is feasible for that devolution of policing and justice to be brought to the Assembly for a cross-community vote at the beginning of March, and to be achieved as devolution around the beginning of May. And I heard all parties want to ensure that the arrangements for cooperation between the parties was enhanced in the future. And I heard everybody round the table want to make sure that would happen. On the question of parades, we believe there is a reasonable basis for agreement.
And that's Gordon Brown just speaking a couple of weeks ago. But it's a bit of a tight deadline, isn't it? He wants all this signed, sealed and delivered at the beginning of May before the election.
Yes, he's got an election coming up, so he's prepared to pledge anything in the world to make sure he gets returned to power after sitting in Tony Blair's reflected sunshine for 13 years.
Well, I mean, the election's turning out much tighter than people expected. The Conservatives, actually, their leaders are not actually up to the job in terms of managing the economy, and I think the electorate are starting to smell that. But it's not been easy, I can tell you, canvassing for the Labour Party in recent years, because they've done some very disappointing things.
Right, well, I'd like to leave one of the final words to our soldier friend, Richard Cowley, who's been on most of the programme, and I asked him about this whole business of the peace and whether he thinks that there are is a good prospects for peace as a soldier who was serving over there in 1980 as part of the parachute regiment.
Moving on from then, that's 1980 to now, that's 2010, is a long time ago. And so during that time, I've obviously been studying politics and all that kind of stuff and religious issues. Well, I can say that I feel very sorry for people who've had to have lived in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, especially in Belfast. You know, it must be terrible for everyone all round, Catholics as well as Protestants. But as far as I'm concerned, I think I speak for most people in the UK, is that we hope that there's going to be a lot of trust in this peace process and that it's going to develop as best as possible. I have actually read the three strands that actually make up the peace process, and I've seen a condensed version. And it seems to me that, in fact, it does lean towards the advantage of the nationalists rather than the British. So I think the British have actually bent over backwards in many ways to accommodate the peace process. So I think they should be given all the respect they deserve for that.
That was Richard Cowley, ex-member of the Parachute Regiment, giving his thoughts about the prospects for peace in the future, which sounds pretty positive. Now, that brings to a close our look at the Good Friday Agreement and a sort of chronological look at the history of all the things that led up to it. But on Good Friday, let's have a look at, excuse me, at Easter. Easter is an English term, according to the Venerable Bede, and it relates apparently to Estra, who is a Teutonic goddess of the rising light of day and the spring, which deity, however, is otherwise unknown, even in the Edda, the Anglo-Saxon. Various other names are given to this, Old High German Ostra and Oestra. So that's where the actual word Easter comes from. The Easter is the principal feast of the ecclesiastical year. That is, say, bigger than Christmas. Pope Leo I called it the greatest feast and says that Christmas is celebrated only in preparation for Easter. It's also linked up with the Old Testament. Maybe, Billy, you could help us out here. What are the links between Easter and the Old Testament and Moses and the Passover?
You went to a Catholic school, did you not?
The Catholic schools are notorious for not letting you into the Old Testament. The one thing, Easter basically, it was stapled onto the reason that Jesus was in Jerusalem in the first place was to celebrate Passover. Now, Passover goes back to the Old Testament when the Israelites were a subjugated and slave population of the Egyptians, upon whom God perpetuated some plagues, the final of which being the killing of all of the firstborn. The expression Passover comes from the lamb's blood, which the Jews, the Israelites, daubed over the doors of their houses so that God's acolytes wouldn't come and take their firstborn from them. It was a signal. And that's why Jesus ended up in Jerusalem. He turned up on Palm Sunday, turned over the tables in the temple, got him into trouble, and by Friday he was on the cross.
Okay, finally, thanks very much for that, Billy. This is just about this Eddie Shoestring series. Now, this is a series which was out in 1979 to 1980, but if you go onto the internet on tv-memories.com for the princely sum of £13, you can get hold of it. And we've got Tim Pemberton on next week, who's from BBC Radio Bristol, so maybe we'll ask him why it hasn't been released. That's tv-memories.com.